The following program is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, producing products that encourage you to eat wisely.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this weekly journey through culinary history. And lately, happily so, we're hearing more and more stories about the hidden faces, the hidden names behind so much of America's history. And today, our topic is another hidden story, and those are the stories of the hidden people behind the kitchen doors, specifically in the White House. Indeed, black chefs in the White House. Very interesting. And my guest is Adrian Miller, who has written a book called The President's Kitchen Cabinet, the story of the African Americans who have fed our first families from the Washingtons to the Obamas, published by University of North Carolina Press. In this book, and we'll get into more of that when we start talking to Adrian Miller, it's really uncovering not only the stories of who was there, but trying to find out, indeed, who was there, because the records are very sparse, as my guest is shaking his head. Adrian Miller is, as he says, a recovering attorney. Well, we're going to get into that one, too.
All right.
A food writer, attorney, and certified barbecue judge. I love that one, who lives in Denver, Colorado. He's the executive director of Colorado Council of Churches, the first African-American and first layperson to hold that position. He previously served as a special assistant to President Bill Clinton and a senior policy analyst for the Colorado Governor Bill Ritter Jr. So you're no newcomer to the White House in politics, right?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've been a board member of the Southern Foodways Alliance, and your first book, Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time, won a James Beard Foundation Award for Scholarship and Reference in 2014. And I'm really happy to have you here to talk about this because, as I said, it's a topic of the, I can't say the year, because it's been going on for several years, but I think it's a very important topic, something we all need to hear.
Mm-hmm.
How did you do it? How did you find out?
Yeah. So first of all, thanks for having me.
You're more than welcome.
So while I was researching the book on the history of soul food, I read about 3,000 interviews and oral histories of formerly enslaved people reminiscing on their childhood and their early adult life. I read thousands of newspaper articles and magazine articles because there are companies that are digitizing these sources and the word searchable, interviews and other things. And then I went to presidential libraries. And so it was through that I found about 150 African Americans who have been in the presidential kitchen from George Washington to the current administration.
Well, interesting, because I would imagine a lot of them didn't have much information about them, not even probably last name. Some of them would be just by one name only.
Right.
In the early days, because they were slaves.
Right. So it took a lot of cross research and just trying to connect sources, because often a newspaper would say colored cook or just the head cook. They wouldn't even bother to mention their name, or they might give a first name or a last name. And so it took a lot to just kind of piece that together. So in my book, I have a chart where I identify people where I could get the full name. So there are a lot of administrations where I just couldn't get that. But a lot of folks out there waiting to be identified. And the cool thing that's happening is, since the book has come out, I have the relatives of some of these cooks coming forward.
Oh, time for another book.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Let that happen. Yeah, I love the chart where you identify them with the presidential term that they were serving
Correct.
Under. And, of course, I would imagine some of them, too, stayed on for a long time, just in the background, cooking for whomever, right?
Well, it depends, because most of the White House cooks have been accidental in the sense that they were either the enslaved cook or the private cook of someone who became president. So usually after the presidential term ended, they went back with that president, you know, that former president into private life.
To their house, right?
But you do have a few people who stay on administration after administration. One woman I love to write about, there's just not a lot of information about her, is a woman named Esserline Dewberry, who ends up cooking from Truman all the way to Reagan.
Wow.
And she's in several White House pictures, but she was never previously identified until my research. Mm. Now I'm working with the White House Historical Association to give name to some of the cooks in these pictures.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the chefs, period, outside of, I mean, in America, were never the headliners until probably about 20 years ago, 25 years ago. It was always the restaurateur was a headliner. So it's not totally unusual that we don't know who was cooking.
Right.
However, in a White House, there should be record of that. Right.
And the interesting thing is, it's really more of a faded history, because in the time contemporary to when these cooks were doing their thing, some of them were written about in newspapers. So they were celebrated in their time, but just as time passes, we just forget about people. So this is the first book that really brings a collective biography to that amazing group of people.
What I know, there are so many people I would want to talk about, because the stories are fascinating.
Uh-huh.
They go outside the kitchen too, but
yeah.
Some of the stories. But as far as I guess some of the talk about, we know a lot, not a lot, but we know names of some of the earliest identified cooks, and certainly with George Washington, there was Hercules.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about a few that come to mind that you feel were really had interesting stories that were, I mean, they all have interesting stories, but that were probably better known than others.
The better known ones or the lesser known?
Or both.
Oh, okay.
Both.
So one woman I love to talk about is a woman named Laura Dolly Johnson.
Uh-huh. I love her too.
Yeah, she was the cook for Benjamin Harrison. And she was a reluctant White House cook because she was basically cooking for a guy named John Mason Brown in Lexington, Kentucky. A young Theodore Roosevelt comes over for dinner. He's so impressed that when Benjamin Harrison gets elected, he recommends Dolly Johnson to be the cook. But she wanted to retire from private cooking and open a catering business. So they twist her arm. She ends up going to the White House. There was one slight problem. There was a white French woman named Madame Pelunard who was already in that position, and she was not feeling all these headlines announcing Dolly Johnson's hire. So this very French cook has two American responses. One, she goes to the press and starts bad-mouthing the eating habits of the Harrisons. Chief among their sins was that they ate a lot of pie, especially for breakfast. And then she files a lawsuit. So she's the first example of a White House employee suing a sitting president.
Oh.
But it all gets worked out, and Dolly Johnson gets to work in the kitchen.
Yeah. And that's interesting. So that was in Benjamin Harrison's term, right?
Yeah, 1891. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And she did, in fact, go on to open a catering business, did she not?
She did. And so she's one of the few examples where we have of an African American leaving the White House kitchen and actually trading on their notoriety to start their business. Because you see that as an example with several white cooks, but she's the first African-American we know of.
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, those who were bound in slavery, you know, couldn't do that. They couldn't even leave, such as Hercules I mentioned with George Washington.
Yeah.
I mean, he could not leave.
Right. And so because he couldn't leave, he eventually finds out a way to leave, and he's one of the great examples of a person who escapes. And Washington was a very vindictive person, so Hercules disappears necessarily because if you know the example of Oney Judge, who was a personal servant to Martha Washington, who escaped in Philadelphia a few years before Hercules did, you know all of the antics that Washington went to try to retrieve her, including trying to trick her and other things.
So, well, you can share a little bit of that with the listeners, because I'm sure that they don't know a lot of that.
Yeah. So Oney Judge, she makes it all the way to New Hampshire, and Washington was just furious that this happened. So he actually dispatches people to go to New Hampshire under the guise of, you know, being friendly people or whatever in order to trick Oney to coming back. But she was too smart for it. So she never fell for it. So Hercules had a lot of liberties. He was allowed to kind of walk about town, dress up in a blue suit and a gold cane, go to the opera.
Quite a dandy, I read. Huh?
Yeah. And he got to sell leftovers out of the kitchen. I mean, this brother's cooking was so good. He made $2,000 a year in the 1790s selling leftovers.
Yeah.
But his son, Richmond, who was an assistant cook in the presidential kitchen, gets caught with a lot of money. And Washington immediately suspects that this was going to finance an escape attempt. So rather than sending Hercules and Richmond back to Mount Vernon's kitchen as punishment, quote unquote, he sends them to the fields. So this renowned chef is now in the fields doing hard labor. And so on Washington's 65th birthday, while everyone's distracted, he actually successfully escapes. We don't know where exactly. He may have gone to Philadelphia initially, but there's speculation that he may have gone to Europe because there's a painting of him, believed to be him, sitting in a museum in Madrid, Spain. And the painting is called A Cook for George Washington, and it's painted by Gilbert Stuart, the same guy who did the iconic portrait of Washington. And if you look at the clothing in that painting, it's what a European chef would have worn as a professional attire during that time, not an American chef.
All right.
But he disappears.
Well, of course, we know a lot about Jefferson's chef Hemings, James Hemings. And he went to Europe with Jefferson, however, for training. But Hercules supposedly knew a lot of, they were trained in French cuisine.
Right, because that was
cook. That was the accept, right?
Right, that was the cuisine of the time.
Fine dining, yes.
Yeah. So when Hercules learns how to cook, he initially was a boat ferryman when he's purchased by the Washingtons. He was a teenager. And for whatever reason, they transfer him to the kitchen. So he actually apprentices under an enslaved cook named Old Doll. So she's the one who teaches Hercules how to cook. So I'm not sure how much actual French training he got, but I'm sure that with Samuel Francis running the kitchen and other things, he got well-schooled in fine dining. But James Hemings, who never becomes a presidential cook because he drinks himself to death before Jefferson becomes president, he's actually, you know, trained for 3 years at an exorbitant cost to cook very fine dining, including things like mac and cheese.
So, yeah. Which, funny how that went from, you know, from fine, high quality dining to comfort food, right?
Yeah. Wait, you don't think the Blue Box is fine dining?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
No, but you can, but certainly versions of it can be, indeed. And the food. So that's an interesting thing because the food. For, of course, we hear about the banquets, the state dinners and things. And those, of course, is where they're going to pull out all the stops and have them cook this refined cuisine, whether it's French or just, you know, a high quality cuisine. But often these cooks had to also, they had to cook, they'd be very versatile. They had to cook what the presidents liked.
Right. So the pattern in the 19th century was typically that the African-American cooks, the private cooks, did the family meals. But when it came time for the state dinners and the big parties, they would actually hire a French cook to cater. So they would hire someone outside the White House. Then when we get to the 20th century, that's the time when you see White House cooks doing everything. And part of that was as a cost-saving move. And then eventually you get to the current era where you have the White House cooks doing everything. But sometimes, and the Obamas did this more than others, they have a guest chef come in and do the state dinners. And there's mixed reactions about that because a state dinner for a White House cook, that's your time to really shine.
That's when you get to show off,
right? Right, right. So to cede that to someone else can, you know, ruffle a little feather, a few feathers.
Yeah, I guess, you know. Of course, you know, we're talking about a period of a lot of time. I mean, cooking in Philadelphia when the White House was there and the Capitol was there too. Then going to Washington, D.C. And the working conditions were not exactly prime.
No. So if you've ever spent any time in D.C., the White House was not air-conditioned until the Truman administration after all of the big renovations. So it was a part-time residence. So people would stay there until maybe late May, early June, and then they would just get
escape.
The heck. Yeah. But for whatever reason, Jefferson in particular had two enslaved women who were his assistant cooks while he was in the White House. He had a French guy named Honoré Julien as the main chef. But these two women, Edith Fawcett and Frances Hearn, he forced them to stay year-round. And separated from their families, there's accounts of their husbands escaping Monticello to try to visit them. And Jefferson would intercept them before they got to D.C. and send them back. They gave birth to kids in the basement. And there were reports in the 19th century of White House workers getting tropical diseases.
Wow.
Because D.C. is a reclaimed swamp area.
Yeah, the foggy bottom.
Right. And periodically, the White House basement would flood where the kitchen is. And so by the time you get to Benjamin Harrison's time and Caroline Harrison, the floods had rotted the floor so much that there were actually a lot of vermin there. And Caroline Harrison wanted to actually relocate the White House to another part of D.C. But, you know, citizens were not having that.
I don't think there was a window in the original kitchen either, was there?
In the original kitchen, there were, because you could actually look in if you were coming into the White House, in the original location. You could actually look in and see what was being made. And then Mary Todd Lincoln wanted the kitchen moved to its current location in the northwest corner of the basement because she wanted more light.
Good. Well, I do. In fact, I posted the picture of Dolly Johnson in the White House kitchen.
Oh, nice.
For the lead picture on the show, along with a picture of you.
Okay.
But because it is so rare to have an early photograph of a White House kitchen.
Yes.
So it's a dark photo, but it's so wonderful to see that.
Right. So I love the fact that here you have an African-American woman in the center of the kitchen, which I think is a great metaphor for the face of White House cooking, because until the modern period, the face of White House cooking was pretty much an African-American woman. It wasn't until we get to the Theodore Roosevelt administration that you start to have kind of foreign white women running the White House kitchen for a 20-year period. Mm. So we had a Swedish and Irish cook phase there. But for the most part, it was black women really dominated a lot of the White House cooking. And let me just say, the presidential kitchen has been multiracial from day one. But if you look at it, the majority of cooks, they were usually African-American.
Interesting. Yeah. And of course, the first lady would get credit for organizing the food and planning the menus, and we all knew she wasn't in there getting her hands, filled with flour. But
exactly, and that was apropos of the time, right? In any context,
and
it was
still,
usually,
I think, still to a large degree. I mean, there's who's calling the shots, you know.
Wait a minute. So if I came and cooked at your house, you take credit for everything?
I would say I gave him the menu, right? No, that's a little different. So where was there, I think of so many of the dishes that, you have some great recipes in the book. I forgot to mention that. There are some really incredible recipes in the book that are either adapted from that's the other thing. We have very few records of recipes, right?
Very few. Before the 1950s, you only saw recipes printed in books. If a White House staffer wrote a memoir, like a woman named Mrs. Elizabeth Jaffrey, she has a lot of recipes in her book. Of course, there's the White House cookbook, but the provenance of that cookbook is under question. It's not clear that it actually was White House recipes that were used, but it was a huge seller. And then periodically, you find recipes printed in the newspaper. But then in the 1950s, that's when you start to see menus get printed more regularly and saved, and then still more and more recipes come out. And I think presidents start to understand the power of food. I think Franklin Roosevelt really used that to his advantage, and so did Eisenhower. Eisenhower was probably the president who loved to cook the most.
Yeah, he was always grilling, right?
Yeah,
he was always out there on the barbecue. Right?
Yeah, he put a grill on the top of the rooftop of the White House, so people would be walking by on 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. They see smoke coming out of the White House. It's the president up there grilling.
So he was president and cook. Right?
Yeah.
Well, there are so many wonderful stories, and I want to talk more about researching the recipes when we come back after a short break, so stay tuned. I'm Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past, and I enjoy finding out about history in all of our foods. Bob's Red Mill, an Oregon-based company producing stone-ground flours and cereals and so much more, is filled with history. From its Roman-style, old-world stone-grinding mills to the interesting varieties of whole grains and seeds that they offer. For instance, Bob's Red Mill has grains and seeds such as amaranth, chia, quinoa, farro, teff, foods that go back thousands of years from around the globe. And they're not just ancient history. These super grains are becoming more popular in modern day recipes because cooks recognize the healthy qualities and are finding delicious ways to incorporate them in meals. Quinoa, for instance, is so versatile. I love using it as a salad or as a savory side dish. Bob's Red Mill encourages you to eat wisely. Look for their products in your local stores or check them out online at bobsredmill.com and explore their huge range of products and recipes. And use the code Taste of the Past for 25% off your order. We're back, and I'm talking with Adrian Miller, whose recent book is I call it so many different things. I want to read the right title here. Exactly. It is from the cover of the book, I will tell you.
Okay.
You could tell me.
I was going to say, I can help you out.
The President's Kitchen Cabinet. Because I've called it so many different things to give it a fancy title for different shows.
Okay.
The President's Kitchen Cabinet, the story of African Americans who have fed our first families from the Washingtons to the Obamas. And we were talking during the break about some interesting stories and what to pick and choose, because we're not going to give the whole book away. People have to read the book. But it is not just a running history of one chef, one cook after another, but the stories, the interesting stories that took place during different administrations. And you brought up the interesting stories that occurred during the civil rights movements.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that, and who was there, and who was cooking, and who were they listening to?
Right. So a lot of times these cooks were civil rights advocates, maybe reluctantly, but Zephyr Wright is probably the most notable example. So she is the longtime cook for the Johnsons. She starts cooking for them in the 1940s, and she moves with the family to Washington. And at that time, the family would drive back from their ranch in Central Texas to Washington. They drive back and forth. And on the initial early trips, Zephyr Wright would ride along with them, but she suffered so many indignities. You know, she wasn't allowed to go to the bathroom with the family, wasn't allowed to eat with them, that she refused to make the trip. So she would live in Washington year-round. So fast forward, when Johnson becomes president, he actually uses her Jim Crow experiences to lobby for the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
Mm-hmm.
After the bill is passed, you know, the presidents, they sign these bills with tons of pens. He presents her with one of the pens and says, "You deserve this as much as anyone."
Wow.
And a lot of times, if civil rights advocates could not get the ear of the president, they would go to the cook and just ask, "Hey, could you mention this while you're, you know, making dinner for
him? Giving him his bowl of soup, say."
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And so-and-so said.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we know that Frederick Douglass was, a couple of the people were, got in and got the president's ears, but that was difficult.
And sometimes at great cost. The most infamous dinner, if you want to say it this way, was when Booker T. Washington had a meal at the White House, and it's the circumstances of that meal are debated. But he ends up having a meal with Theodore Roosevelt, and the nation was scandalized, especially the South, and people editorialized about it. There were speeches in Congress: "How dare you entertain a black man in the White House?" That's how hectic it got back then. So, but then, you know, there are other times when you have black staffers and cooks and others feeling like they were defending the president, because, of course, in many situations, presidents weren't doing enough. And so they had to tell African-Americans, he's doing what he can, given the circumstances, that kind of thing.
Right.
So it was a really interesting dynamic.
Wow. The power of the kitchen, the power of who's making the food.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting, even in the semantics, you mentioned before, they wouldn't have a name. They'd be called a colored cook or a Negro cook, but always cook, never a chef.
Right.
Just a cook. That happened for a long time, up until recently, didn't it not?
Correct. And I think that a lot of that has to do with chef became a classification in the labor system, I guess, in the 1970s because of some lobbying by chef organizations. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, cook in a restaurant, if you run a restaurant,
right,
then you're a chef.
Right. Right. So, I think it's an artificial distinction, but other people would say it has much more meaning. But I think that has a lot to do with it.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Some of the stories that are there, they're hilarious stories too, and there have been other accounts of, for instance, FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, and he had a couple of favorite cooks, but they weren't the White House cook. We know from stories of Eleanor Roosevelt how horrible the food was during his administration, but he had some little sneaky side cook mistresses, if you will.
Yeah, so one I love is Daisy Bonner. So Daisy Bonner is a cook in Warm Springs, Georgia, and Franklin Roosevelt would go there weeks at a time to get treatments for his polio. So to ingratiate themselves with the president, a local wealthy white family would lend their black cook to the president weeks at a time, and that was Daisy Bonner. So she got him hooked on all kinds of Southern food. Country Captain, are you familiar with that? It's a chicken curry dish.
But you can talk about it. I mean,
you
don't have a recipe for that in the book, though, do you?
I don't, because I couldn't find one ascribed to her.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So the one I use is the Edna Lewis one in The Gift of Southern Cooking. But I couldn't find her. That was really good. Let me just put it that way.
It's like a chicken curry, basically.
Yes.
You know, not, I mean, that's pretty basic. Bringing it down to basic, but that's,
right. Yeah. And then other Southern favorites, Brunswick stew, a chicken vegetable stew. But the thing he was really hooked on were pig's feet. FDR loved pig's feet. And the way she would make them is she would broil them, split them, and butter them. And
a little butter with my pig fat. Yes, yeah. Right.
And he actually loved them so much that he served them to Winston Churchill in the White House. And we know this because one of the African-American butlers wrote about it in his memoir, a guy named Alonzo Fields. And let's just say that Churchill was not feeling pig's feet. He thought they were slimy, had an interesting texture.
Yeah, it was an American delicacy you just had to get into. Well, actually, it's French, too.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Alon, you mentioned Alonzo's name. There were so many other people working in the White House, well, in ancillary positions. I mean, the stewards, the butlers, the servers. I mean, it was, you know, there was a lot going on there.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of people know about the movie The Butler that came out in 2012. Great film. One of the things that I wish they had shown more was the teamwork aspect between the butlers and the kitchen. Because they're all trying to make the president and the first family feel happy and comfortable and well-fed. And so service was very important to them. So, but there was a huge teamwork aspect, you know. Whenever the first family needed anything, they wanted to be sure that they could meet that need.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, as I mentioned before, it wouldn't necessarily be food that this cook, if this were a trained cook, in fact, at the time, would have served or cooked on her own, primarily her, right? Mm-hmm. But the requests of the first family, what they wanted to be served, right?
Oh, it was more collaborative than that, actually. Yeah. So a lot of it depended on what the first lady wanted. So typically, the first lady took charge of all the domestic operations and the food. And if it was a longtime personal cook, you know, they probably didn't meddle too much because they knew that cook knew what the first family wanted. And we had a lot of Southern cooks, right? So a lot of times it was Southern food being served in the residence, mm-hmm. not necessarily for the, you know, fancy guest meals. But there would come a time when then the first lady would work with the executive chef to plan menus. And sometimes the chef would propose a menu and the first lady would either just sign off on it or make changes.
All right.
So yeah, it just depended on the administration, but it could be very collaborative.
But as much as everything a president does today becomes political fodder,
right.
So it was in, well, particularly LBJ's term. There was that great story about the chili.
Oh, yeah. It's one
and
of my favorite.
Zephyr Wright, uh-huh. You know, cooking. You can share that with us.
So for all the Texans listening, you know that the distinctive thing about Texas chili is it has no beans. It's beanless. So the White House released a recipe for Pedernales River chili. That's the river that runs alongside the ranch in Central Texas, the LBJ Ranch. And the nation was scandalized. And they wanted to be reassured that their president liked beans. So the White House goes into spin control. And in my book, I actually have the transcript of a recorded conversation where the Juanita Roberts, the social secretary, is talking to Zephyr Wright about all the beans that the president likes and how he likes them. Lady Bird Johnson said that recipe card was the second most requested document from the federal government in 1964.
The one for the chili or without beans?
The chili without beans. The only thing that was asked about more was the newly formed women and children nutrition program. Hmm. So that recipe got him in some hot water. Yeah.
Well, you are no stranger to political action groups like that, too. In fact, when you were an assistant to Bill Clinton, you worked for the America First.
Initiative
for One America, right.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Tell us about that. What was that?
So that was an outgrowth of President Clinton's initiative on race, which was launched in 1998, chaired by the late John Hope Franklin. And the idea behind the initiative on race was, and this is going to sound crazy, if we just talked to one another and listened, we might realize that we have a lot more in common. And so that did its work. I know, crazy, right?
Yeah, right. Novel idea.
Yeah.
Right.
So that did its work for about a year and a half. And after that ended, John Hope Franklin and the others running that said, Mr. President, you need to continue this on an ongoing basis. So that became the initiative for One America. And the way I got involved is a law school classmate of mine from Georgetown Law School asked me if I had friends back in Denver who might be interested in working for that, or I'm sorry, in DC, I was in Denver at the time, if I had friends who would be interested in working that. And so I did the same thing that Dick Cheney did when George W. Bush asked him to find a vice president. I was the head of the search committee, only my name went on the list. So I went and worked there.
Hey, listen, you know, there are times when you get to pull the strings, right?
That's right, that's right.
Good
so,
for you.
Yeah, that was great. So it was about racial, religious, and ethnic reconciliation.
Yeah, interesting.
So it was an interesting time.
So the whole food, getting into the whole food writing, I mean, obviously you started, you started out with your first book on writing about the history of soul food, or what is soul food really, and
right,
exploring that.
Yeah.
How did you decide to jump into food?
So the short answer is unemployment.
Oh, well.
Okay. So when I ended my stint in the Clinton White House, what happens in a change of administration is that as a political appointee, you have to write out your letter of resignation and submit it to the incoming president. Shockingly, George W. Bush accepted mine. So I was out of a job and I started watching way too much daytime television. So I said, you know, I need to read something. So I went to the bookstore and I'm browsing the shelves and I see John Edgerton's Southern Food at Home on the Road in History. And early in that book, he wrote that the tribute to African-American achievement in cookery has yet to be written. So I thought that was interesting. The book was about 10 years old at that time. So I figured somebody had written it in the interim. So I reached out to him by email. He responded and said, you know, nobody's really taken on the full story. People have done pieces of
it. Right,
there were
some.
Yeah. So for whatever reason, the only qualifications I had was eating a lot of soul food and cooking it some, I decided to dive in. And that started the journey to write the book.
Well, and you were on the board of Southern Foodways for a while as well, right?
I was, and that helped.
Speaking of John Edgerton.
Yeah, that helped immensely because I got to meet John Edgerton, got to get to know him, John T. Edge, and other Jessica Harris. Tony Tipton Martin, some just other luminaries in the field. And I learned a lot about Southern
food. All of whom who have been on the show, I have to tell you.
Ah, great. So I got to know a lot about Southern food from going to the symposium, the annual symposium, right, reading sources and things. So that was a huge help. Otherwise, I think I would have made a lot more errors in my book. I probably would have said platitudes and stuff that people,
right,
had, you know.
And I think that was a problem with a few of the smaller books that came before you, is that they weren't really researched. Well, it's difficult. It's a difficult topic to,
yeah,
you know, to find, to research.
And again, if I didn't have the internet and the word searchable, digitized newspaper articles from the 1800s and stuff, it would have been a very different book.
Yeah. It's made all our, those of us in research, made our lives so much easier.
Well, I'm glad I could help. Yeah. I'm here for you.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the internet, it's wonderful. Yeah. So what's next for you?
So my next book is going to be on the history of African-American barbecue culture, because I've just consumed so much food media that talks about barbecue and they don't mention African-Americans, which is just crazy because if you know anything about the American barbecue story, African-Americans are central to it, not on the periphery.
Well, be sure to pick up Zora Neale Hurston's book.
Which one?
Well, when she wrote for the WPA, the for the,
okay,
the America Eats project, and goes down to Florida to discover Florida food.
Right.
I think that was called Florida food.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's a great one to look at. Yeah.
So that's the next thing, and then after that, I hope to do a book on African American street vendors, because they were the food trucks of the 1800s and did a lot to shape the food scenes in a lot of cities that we know and love. New Orleans, Philadelphia, Savannah, Charleston.
Oh, maybe that one should come first. Right?
New York. Yeah. Well, barbecue's my first love.
I know. Barbecue's, and you need barbecue judge. Of course, it's your first love.
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking there's so much barbecue out there, you know, but street vendors, so, you know, particular niche, you know, I think that's a wonderful idea.
And check this out. I actually have the sheet music and the words for some of their street cries.
Wow. Where were those kept?
In newspapers.
Huh.
They would actually print the bars, the musical bars and everything. So you can, you know, I'm not a great singer, but.
And then you would identify, that truck and you would know where he was, you know, located.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is, I can't wait for that one.
That's going
to
be cool.
Yeah. That's going to have to be a movie.
I think so. Are you a singer?
No.
I was going to say, I can sign you to contract.
No.
Okay.
That would be treacherous.
But yeah, just think if I could get Beyonce and others to.
Yeah. And then have a little food and entertainment. And I can see a whole production on that one. Well, Adrian, it's a pleasure to hear you talk about this research in the book firsthand, because it's a wonderful book. And there's been so much wonderful press, wonderful things written about it.
Thank you.
And stories that we need to hear. And now you have to write an addendum, right?
With all the news stories.
Yeah, all the relatives coming out of the woodwork saying, oh my God, I saw you mention my mother's name. And now would be great-great-grandmother.
Yeah. And the coolest thing is that they said, I'm just so honored that you wrote well about my ancestor. So they're proud, you know. And some of them were saying, hey, you know, you got this wrong, because I was relying on a lot of secondary sources, because there's just not a lot of primary sources about people. So I do want to kind of round out the picture and say, okay, this is what really happened and stuff. So it's cool to hear it.
And a test for the listeners out there, because we don't really pay attention to a lot of these things. Quick, who's the current White House chef?
You want me to answer that?
You can answer it. I know it too, but you can answer it.
All right. So her name is Christetta Comerford. She has actually been in the White House kitchen since the Clinton administration.
Right.
She became the White House chef the second term of George W. Bush. She's cooked all throughout the Obama years, and now she's currently cooking for
us. She's Filipino,
I think?
Yeah, Filipino chef, yeah. And a woman. It's funny how they went in a rash of there were men, and then all of a sudden it was all women, and then there were, you know, back to the, I have to say, the exalted head chef being a man.
Right.
Now we're back to a woman, which I'm very happy to
And hear. Interesting, so not only do we have Christetta Comerford as the White House executive chef, but Susan Morrison is the White House pastry chef.
Ah.
And I think she's the first in the modern era, because in the 1800s, we had black women as the pastry chef.
Yeah.
But in the modern era, she's the first one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Anyone's story you couldn't get, who you knew about but couldn't get as a final?
Yeah. So I couldn't get stories of a lot of the recent alums of the White House kitchen. I reached out to them, and all of the African-American ones I reached out to denied my request. And I think there's a lot going on there. First of all, they just didn't know who I was, and they didn't know if I was out to get dirt. There is definitely a code of silence.
I would imagine, yeah.
But here's the thing. I reached out to several white people who were former White House cooks, and five out of the six, not only did they talk to me, but, you know, they were very, very helpful in identifying a lot of White House culture, including Walter Scheib. Before his tragic death, he was answering a lot of questions for me. So it's very interesting. They've all signed the same paperwork, yet some felt they had more liberty to talk about their experience. And I think, you know, for the African-American cooks, there probably were more professional repercussions for them if they were to be seen as talking out of shop.
Right, right.
And I think that's real.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Very interesting note to end on. Well, I look forward to so much more coming from you. And if you are listening today on March 1st, 2018, because we have people listening at all different times on podcasts, and you're in the New York City area, Adrian Miller will be presenting to the Culinary Historians of New York. So check it out.
Yeah, it's going to be a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Adrian.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Ever wonder what kind of podcast Julia Child would have made? Probably would have been one where she introduced you to all of her latest discoveries and favorite people. And that's exactly the tradition we're following on Inside Julia's Kitchen, a podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. Join me, Todd Shulkin, your host, and the Foundation's Executive Director, as I bring you inside the Foundation's world to meet the bright lights of today's food universe, just as Julia used to do from her own famous kitchen. New episodes air on Heritage Radio Network, Wednesdays at noon Eastern. Listen in.